Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello and welcome to another episode on the New Books Network. I'm one of your hosts, Dr. Miranda Melcher, and I'm very pleased today because we get to talk about quite an intriguing book, an intriguing project. I mean, there's really so many things here. The book is titled The Inhumans and Other Stories, and it's published by MIT Press as part of the Radium Age series. And is really interesting because it's a collection of stories, it's more than one, that have never before been translated or published in English, part of a unique genre from the early 20th century in Bengali. We get to, those of us who don't read Bengali, get to engage with these stories for the very first time, which is incredibly exciting. And I'm very pleased to welcome the translator and compiler of this great book, Dr. Bodhisattva Chattopadhyay, to the podcast to tell us all about it. Bodhisattva, thank you so much for being with us to tell us about this epic work.
Thank you, Miranda. It's a pleasure to be here. This is a work of early Bangla science fiction. So not only are some of these stories, not only have they never been translated before, some of these stories are also not well known. So even within Bengal, except the title story. So the title story, which is The Inhumans, it's a novella, that is extremely well known. But the others are much less known. So it has been quite fun translating these stories and putting them in conversation with each other for this series.
Yeah, no, I can imagine, even just with that little bit of information, though, of course, I have the benefit of having read the book, so I sort of know some of what we're going to get to talk about. Could you tell us maybe a bit before we get into the stories, kind of a bit about your intellectual background and how you came to take on this project and be part of this series?
So I am an associate professor at the University of Oslo, and I deal with global culture studies. But my background is in science fiction studies and science fiction research. So I did my doctoral work on colonial Bengal and colonial Bangla and British science fiction. So late 19th, early 20th century science fiction from Britain and Bengal. And I was alongside, you know, all the canonical writers like, you know, E.G. Wells and so on, and Olaf Stapledon. I was also looking at the development of Bangla science fiction, or Bangla Kalpavigyan, as we call it. Now, a lot of these stories happen before the term science fiction itself becomes common or becomes commonplace. The term itself dates back to 1851, but in popular consciousness, the term science fiction only becomes popular in the 1930s, 40s, and much later. So I was trying to put the colonial Bangla stories and the colonial British stories in conversation within a comparative framework, trying to understand what is science fiction before science fiction. And in order to do that, I had to get into what is science. So what are the cultural constituents that go into making science in any particular context? How would a Bengali define science? How would a British writer define science in the same period? Are there things in common? So more than the fiction part of it, because the fiction part of it is much more easily seen that, oh, these are fictional works. It was the science that I dug into. So my background is actually colonial science fiction. But over the last 5, 6, 7 years, I have been developing this project called CoFutures at the University of Oslo, which is on contemporary futurisms. So how do people around the world imagine futures? So I think these two things kind of come together in this translation as well. My interest in the colonial period, but also my interest in understanding how do people around the world imagine the future.
Mm. Having read the book and how you've kind of what you've created from all of these pieces, I'm like, yeah, no, I can see all of those elements to it. And I think that's what makes it so interesting. As you just mentioned, science fiction kind of as a term, as a sort of standardized, defined category, didn't exist at the time of these stories. So can you tell us about the genre they're part of, Kalpavigyan, how, when, and why it developed?
So if we want to understand the term Kalpavigyan, the term itself doesn't come up until 60s, 70s in Bengal. When it is used by the writer Odrish Bardhan to refer to the genre. Now, again, there is this question of nomenclature, of deciding the genre label. Now, if we look at the colonial period, the terms that we will find floating around are terms like, you know, scientific romances, or in the case of Jules Verne, extraordinary voyages, and so on. So we have all these terms. In Bengal, we have similar and cognate terms where people are, you know, using terms like Bighan Bhittik Kotha Sahitya, which literally means science-based stories, right? So Kalpavigyan that we use as a label for these stories is actually what, you know, has been called retro-labeling. So it's a form of retro-labeling. So when we talk about H.G. Wells, for instance, as science fiction, it is also a form of retro-labeling. Same with Jules Verne, it is a form of retro-labeling. Or going back to Mary Shelley, the mother of science fiction in the Anglophone context, we will talk about it as science fiction, so that's retro-labeling. So when we are thinking of Kalpavigyan, we are only talking about retro-labeling, really. But if we want to just open that up and say, okay, we accept the retro-labels and so on and so forth, then when did it begin? I think that's a much more difficult question to answer, because it is also language-dependent and context-dependent. In Bengal itself, the earliest future histories come about in the 1830s and 1840s. So you have two works in English, which are future histories or things that are happening in India. They're like, you know, anti-colonial and post-colonial struggles happening in 20th century India. So they predict a 100-year kind of time frame and see what's happening there. But if we want to talk about, you know, origins of science fiction, that's a very, very difficult thing to answer in the Bengali context or in the Indian context, because we often tend to go back to our epic literature and our classical Sanskrit literature and so on. So Kalpavigyan, if one wants to trace the beginnings and the origins, we just keep going back and back and back. And it is all really an instance of retro-labeling. So when people talk about ancient Indian epics like the Ramayana or the Mahabharata having scientific elements or science fictional elements, then that is definitely retro-labeling, just as in the European context or in the Anglophone context or in the Greco-Roman context, we often talk about Lucian and, you know, his early work as an example of science fiction, of European science fiction. So it developed, I would say, in Bengal in the 1830s, 40s, in the form of future histories. And by the 1880s, 1890s, and early 2000s, we have a lot of work with science fictional elements happening in Bengal and happening all over India. So all of these can now be classed together and said, well, here you have it. Here you have the beginnings of Kalpavigyan in India, just as we do it in the Anglophone context with the work of H.G. Wells, or in the French context with the work of Jules Verne.
Mm. Thank you for that helpful context and, of course, the nuance of like, well, where actually do we draw these sorts of lines? If we, however, accept, as you said, the sort of retro labeling and think about these works sort of as, I guess, a genre of some kind, even if the name is not as precise as we might like when it comes to being able to name things true of any sort of genre, what are some of the common topics or tropes or ideas that both are kind of influencing this writing, but also that are being played with by these authors?
So the term retro-labeling in the context of science fiction, I mean, it has been used by several critics, but Rachel Haywood's use of it in this book, The Emergence of Latin American Science Fiction, is perhaps a good example of what we do when we read old science fictional works and call them science fiction. And Rachel Haywood does this in the context of Latin American science fiction. And I think what is really interesting about Haywood's work, but also I would say Indian science fiction more broadly, but also British science fiction, also American science fiction of the same period, is that these works share a lot of things. They have a lot of themes in common. The difference lies in what they do with those themes. So if we talk about shared themes, then one of the main themes that a lot of these works have is the theme of degeneration and race politics, because the ideas behind scientific racism, for instance, they are developed, a lot of these are developed in the mid to the late 19th century, and there's a lot of discussion around, you know, degeneration, which comes up with colonial contact. So all the colonial contact zones are often discussed in literary works as sites of degeneration. I'll take an example from mainstream literature, Joseph Conrad's Heart of Darkness. I mean, that is a classic example of this form of degeneration narrative, that, you know, the protagonist travels from Europe and goes to Africa and goes native and takes on the practices, you know, the so-called barbaric practices of African tribes, right? I mean, it's complete racist nonsense, but it is the basis for a lot of the literature of the period. And it's also true when we look at, for instance, British science fiction. I mean, H.G. Wells and his Time Machine narrative is a classic degeneration narrative. You travel into the future, humanity has split into these, you know, two wildly different groups, the Eloi and the Morlocks, and the Morlocks are these degenerate cannibals that live underground and feed on the Eloi, and the Eloi are degenerate upper class people who are completely dependent on the Morlocks for their survival, but they are described as these almost innocent, childlike, and a bit stupid kind of figure, right? So when we go in time, when we travel forwards in time, according to Wells, we see the effects of degeneration. Now, degeneration is all over the place in late 19th and early 20th century science fiction. And writers like, you know, critics like William Greenslade, for instance, have a, you know, Greenslade has a book on this. You know, there are also works, for instance, on Outcast London and so on. The whole idea that, you know, the moment you travel outside the richer parts of London, you see degeneracy, right? And race mixing is a big source of degeneracy and degeneration. So all these anxieties about, you know, miscegenation, race mixing, contact with, you know, colonial outsiders, going to places, for instance, like Africa or India or, you know, South America, you know, places with indigenous communities, you will always come across discourses of degeneration. So the same tropes that you would find in British science fiction, you also find in Bangla science fiction. You also find it in Latin American science fiction. So, I would imagine that a project for Radium Age, for instance, would next perhaps look at Latin American science fiction, right? Because there are very, very similar things that are happening in that period. So one difference, now that we have the similarities, we need to talk about the differences. And I think the differences in Bangla science fiction are really about humor. Now, let me present this argument a bit differently. So for a writer like A.G. Wells, or for that matter, Rudyard Kipling, or for that matter, you know, some of the other writers from the Radium Age, from that period, such as Arthur Conan Doyle, for instance, in his Professor Challenger stories, now which are actually humorous stories. Now, some of the stories of this period are about colonial contact with the other. Right. So the colonial contact with the other means that the other is presented as an alien or as a degenerate, but often as an alien. Right. So it's the war with the alien. I mean, H.G. Wells again, War of the Worlds. Who's the alien? Who's the Martian? Now, Wells is explicit in the book that, you know, when he's talking about the Martian invasion of England, he's actually talking about what the British and the Europeans did in Tasmania. They wiped out the genocide of the Tasmanians, of the indigenous population, right? So A.G. Wells says, you know, that, well, you know, if the Martians ever came to attack us, you know, they would do that in the same spirit. They would do to us what we did to the Tasmanians, because the Martians are superior, right? So there is this understanding of the alien as enemy, right? Which is very, very clear in a lot of these degeneration narratives, a lot of these, you know, early Radium Age kind of narratives. Now, Radium Age and before. Now, when we go to Bengal, you know, now, here are the aliens themselves writing science fiction, right? If one wants to put it that way, from the lens of Britain or, you know, Anglo-American or European science fiction, if the native is, you know, of the colonized part of the world, if then that native is the alien, here are the aliens writing science fiction, right? So how would the aliens then write science fiction? The way that the aliens will write science fiction is that the aliens will use humor. They will use humor, they will use satire, they will use irony in order to invert the basic tropes of, you know, the genre. The basic tropes of the superhuman, the basic tropes of the alien. All of these will get inverted. All of this will get challenged, right? So I think, you know, in terms of like common topics, tropes, and so on, you have this whole set of tropes, and then you have very specific, I would say, local expressions, whether it's in Britain or in Bengal or in Brazil, you have the local expressions of common tropes.
Yeah, which I think is I'm so glad you emphasized the similarities of the ideas, because it, I think, would be too easy to kind of make assumptions of like, these people are writing over here and those people are writing over there and they're not talking to each other. And yet, as you've just so clearly demonstrated in that answer, there's a whole bunch of things kind of coming up all over the place that different people are taking the different perspectives of, and also aware of how it's being interpreted in other places. So given that discussion, and especially the idea of kind of, okay, well, what's the specific way it's being taken in the Bangla context, can you briefly introduce us to the stories you've included in the collection?
Oh, would love to. So I have included four stories in this collection. So the first of these is The Inhumans, which is the title story by Hemendra Kumar Roy, or as we call him in Bengal, Hemen Rai. So Hemen Rai's Inhumans, or Omanushik Manush, is a novella from 1935. It is very much about this degeneration narrative, and it plays with the degeneration narrative by taking, going to Africa, again, a very common location for a lot of these narratives. So it takes the Bengali protagonist to Africa, where they discover, you know, a race of supermen, so that's one kind of futuristic narrative. And these supermen, they are basically like Nazis. You know, they are, so what we're talking about in this narrative is a race of Nazi-like Bengali supermen in a hidden location, like Wakanda, let's say, in Africa, right? So that's what Inhumans is about. It also deals with degeneration through very much the Kipling kind of narrative, the Jungle Book narrative. So there's the Jungle Book narrative, and then there's the Nazi, Superman kind of narrative. So that's Inhumans. The other story that I have included is a story called Shukro Bhromon by Jagadananda Rai from 1895, translated in my collection as Voyage to Venus. And this is, again, dealing with the theme of degeneration, but through this extraplanetary voyage. The Inhumans is very much the lost race, lost world narrative within the planet, while Voyage to Venus takes us to another planet, takes us to Venus, where you also have, degeneration tropes and so on. What is special about Jagadananda Rai's work is that it is often discussed as the first proper Bangla science fiction work from India. In fact, it is often discussed as the first proper science fiction work from India. We can quibble about this, and we do in the critical community, but it is definitely one of the first. So it was really, I'm really glad that Josh Joshua Glenn, he gave me the freedom to also translate this work as part of this collection, because it kind of puts the entire period and the radium age discussions in context. So this is from 1895, so it's a bit before, but it puts the whole discussion around degeneration, about, racial politics and eugenics and so on, all in context. So that's the second one. Then I have two other stories, Noni Gopal Majumdar's Danob Rahasyo, or Mystery of the Giant, from 1931, and Mongol Puran by Manoranjan Bhattacharya, or the Martian Purana, which is also from 1931. So these two stories are quite different in style and tone. So the Mystery of the Giant is also about racial purity, but it is, in some ways about, you could compare it to, a magic potion kind of narrative, right? Where you take a magic potion and you're transformed into a superhuman. And the narrative challenges and questions this, drive for racial superiority, really. So the narrative is a very, very interesting. It's a short story, and it challenges very much also within this period because Bengali nationalism is growing. So this also is a challenge to Bengali nationalism of that period. Mongol Puran is part of a series of stories by Manoranjan Bhattacharya. But I translated this particular story because it's my favorite. And it also has the Martians. So it's one of the first Martian adventures in Indian science fiction. And what this work does is that it blends, you know, when I earlier mentioned where does Kalpavigyan or when does Kalpavigyan begin? And for a lot of people, they go back to the epics, right? There is often a very, you know, I would say a nationalistic tendency to go back to the epics, which one finds in India, which one finds in a lot of cultures, but we definitely find it a lot in India, a tendency to go back to the epics, to our scriptures and say, oh, we used to have, you know, very advanced science, you know, at that point of time. Oh, we go back 2000 years or we go back 3000 years, you know, we used to be so advanced, right? So what, Manoranjan Bhattacharya's, work does is that it blends, the universe of the Indian epics, the Ramayana and the Mahabharata, with very contemporary 1930s kind of concerns around, you know, modernity and modernism, the speed of cars and so on and so forth. And it blends it with this speculative narrative about, you know, super sophisticated and super advanced Martians. It's a hilarious narrative. So these are the stories. So it's four stories that I have put in this collection.
Thank you so much for taking us through them and a bit also about kind of why you chose them. That's such an interesting aspect of it, given, of course, that you couldn't include everything, right, in one book. So those decisions must have been quite tricky. For that last one, you mentioned that it was your favorite of the collection it came from. Amongst these four, do you have a favorite?
I am not sure that I should say which one is my favorite. But I mean, I love all of them. And I think that they serve different kinds of functions, to be honest. I think Mongol Puran, the last story that I mentioned, I think is perhaps, the funniest, at least for those somewhat familiar with the Indian context and the context of the Indian epics. Perhaps that is the funniest for us. But The Inhumans, which is the title story, is one of my favorite books. So when I was approached for this series, so my first idea was like, oh, this is an opportunity for me to get, Omanushik Manush, Inhumans, out there, because it is such an amazing novella. Right. So I think I have a, I like all the stories, but I have a soft spot definitely for the last story because of its very intelligent use of context. And I also really love the novella because of what it does. And I think what is so special also about Inhumans, why I thought of translating that immediately is because it takes all the tropes of early science fiction, really. There's everything from advanced tech to degeneration to, quasi-aliens to a lost world. All these narratives, they're all in one place. To the feral child narrative, all these narratives that we find, quite often in British and American science fiction, talking about, oh, we are going to the colonial world. This is what we're going to find. We're going to find the feral child, because surely there is a child that has been brought up by wolves or by, chimps or apes, right? So this kind of narrative. So it takes all these narratives and puts them all in the same place. And it's such an amazing experiment, of just bringing the tropes together and seeing where they go, and how would a colonized person respond to those tropes, right? So I think it's a very special artifact of its time, and it continues to resonate, and I think it resonates even more now because so many of these discussions around nationalism and national pride, etc., are coming back, and this is all over the place. Not just in India, it's also here in Europe, and in the US. This very strange kind of nationalistic pride, this idea of somehow going back to the past because the past is better, right? You know, make something great again. So there is this kind of a tendency, this kind of a myth-building tendency that this narrative is very strongly against, which is why I think it continues to resonate to this day in Bengal.
And as you said, in other places too, especially now that it's in English. I completely understand kind of why your mind went immediately to that when this project came up. How did you choose the other three? What were you looking for, stories that kind of each did different things? Did you have, I don't know, a spreadsheet or a list? Like, how did you choose the other three to include?
I wanted stories that spoke to each other. So that was pretty much the only selection criteria for me. There are also a bunch of other stories that I could have included, but didn't. Some of those are already out there. I've already translated some of these stories in other places. So this, I think, is this particular collection is a very special collection because I could spend a lot of time just thinking about what is it that I want to present? What picture of early colonial Bengal and its science fiction or its kalpavigyan do I want to present? So my criteria was really, do these works talk to each other? And how do they do so? And is there a larger kind of cultural picture that I can bring out with this work?
That is such an interesting kind of way of looking at it. And I think there's loads of people probably listening going, oh, I'd love to have a project that lets me think that way. So thank you for telling us about kind of that behind the scenes, I suppose, aspect of it, at least in terms of thinking. Because, of course, then there's the practical element of, all right, you've selected stories that speak to each other, but now they have to be translated. What were some of the challenges of doing that part of the project?
So to go back to my PhD, back when I did my PhD on colonial Bangla and colonial British science fiction, none of the Bangla works were translated. So there was no way I could really write a thesis without engaging in the process of translation. You know, even if it was just select quotes from these stories and so on, and I'm talking about, you know, a decade plus ago, you know, almost 15 years ago, really now. So I had to engage with the process of translation. I had to engage with the idea that, you know, somebody had to understand what was going on, right? And in order to do that, I had to translate these stories, right? I had to translate at least snippets of these stories. But, you know, for me, the PhD process went a bit beyond that because I loved the story. So I was like, why don't I translate a bunch of stuff anyway? So I translated entire stories and put it in this, you know, appendix to my thesis and so on. So one of the challenges for me thinking with translation now was, because I have this, like, you know, my head is full of these colonial Bengal stories, was to go back and think with a lot of the works that I hadn't translated then, to think also with the works that had been translated or had partially translated then, and just forget about all those old translations and start from scratch with this, you know, with this, not a spreadsheet, but it's actually a huge whiteboard, like, you know, what are the words, what are the works that I want here? And how do I go about it? So the main you know, at least at the starting point, the main challenge was, you know, to not go back to anything I had done before, but to tell the story, you know, as it is now, you know, with, you know, all the decade of work that has happened for me in science fiction since then, and bring that understanding and bring that consciousness to the works that I am translating now, because people do grow. So my research since then and my understanding of science fiction or the genre since then, to bring all of that to this new translation. The other thing that, you know, really helped me was that I also produced a science fiction film. It's open access online. It's a documentary on colonial Bengal science fiction, but not just that, leading all the way to the 60s and to, you know, the 2000s. So it's a narrative about science fiction in Bengal and in India. It's a documentary film. So that also helped me, you know, revisit that story of colonial science fiction in Britain and Bengal, and especially in Bengal. And when I set about translating these works now for the series, so I had all the work that I had done in between, the additional archival work that I had done, the developments that have happened in science fiction historiography since then. So I could put all of that into my translation. So that was kind of like, you know, one of the things that really helped me. The other challenge, of course, the main challenge for me when translating was humor. Humor is perhaps the most difficult thing to translate. I have translated works before, and this is a point that is always an issue. How do you translate humor, especially extremely culturally situated, you know, context-based humor, which people outside, you know, that particular context will never understand? How do you translate that, right? So how do you translate very peculiar kind of Bengali or Bangla jokes into English, right? Because as I mentioned earlier, humor is one of the things that really sets these works apart. So for me, that was extremely, extremely important. I wanted to translate that humor. So that was a big challenge.
Yeah, I mean, humor, even being understood within a language, is a challenge, much less translating it across languages and, of course, across time. Given this literally word-by-word engagement with these texts, was there anything that you found going through the process that was sort of surprising or exciting? Maybe in terms of the stories themselves, but I always find what's most interesting about stories written at a different time is kind of what it reveals about the time in which the fiction was written rather than just the content itself. Was there anything like that that you came across?
For me, because I'm so familiar with the context and, you know, because this was my doctoral research, and also, as I mentioned, the work for the documentary and so on. So this is a context that I'm really, really quite familiar with. What was interesting for me as I was translating them again and looking at these stories anew was, you know, how much of contemporary science fiction I can see in these old works, you know, that's really special, because, you know, and I think that is also part of the logic of this whole series. So the Radium Age and that particular period of science fiction, it's kind of, you know, in some ways the lost decades of science fiction, you know, it's pre the more golden age kind of period. It's, you know, it's not H.G. Wells, and it's not, you know, the Asimov, Clark, Bradbury. It's that period in between, you know, the lost period, if one wants to call it that, you know, and a lot of work is happening. A lot of science fiction is coming out. I mean, Blaler has these fantastic, you know, bibliographic works of early science fiction and so on, which shows the vast universe of these narratives. Now, what was really interesting for me to see with these stories, and as I said, also how they resonate so much with contemporary discussions around science fiction, but not science fiction alone, but also what we would call futurisms. So, you know, African futurism or Afrofuturism or indigenous futurisms or Gulf futurism, Latinx futurism. So there's this whole galaxy of futurisms. And as you know, I've been working with these futurisms for the last, you know, 6-7 years. So what was really, you know, surprising to me going back and translating these afresh was how much they resonated. Now, when I say this, what do I really mean? And what do I mean by this resonance? So going back to early science fiction or early Kalpavigyan and so on, what's happening in that period, because there is no genre such as science fiction, or the genre label hasn't been applied yet. You know, the magazines, the main magazines like Amazing Stories or Astounding and so on, they're not there yet. There's a lot of general pulp magazines, a lot of general genre magazines. John Reeder calls this the mass cultural genre system. So, you know, the mass cultural genre system, which has elements of all genres. You know, it has science fiction in there, it has fantasy in there, it has horror in there, you know, it has detective fiction in there, you know, all, you know, a children's adventure in there. So it's like a mix and match of all kinds. It's a mishmash of genres, right? And the mass cultural genre system of that period meant that these stories inhabited this very mixed kind of genre space. So when we look at a lot of the stories from that period, including the stories that are included in this collection, now this mass cultural genre system phenomenon, you know, the whole like idea of all these mixture of genres, one sees this mixture of genres in there, right? I mean, Joseph Conrad's Heart of Darkness, I mentioned that work earlier, and Conrad was, you know, talking to Wells. I mean, his Heart of Darkness is actually very much a Wellsian narrative, right? He talks about the visitors to, you know, to Africa, and he says, you know, to Congo, and he says, you know, there's a line from Heart of Darkness, which is, this also, you know, we were wanderers. We were wanderers in a prehistoric earth. So the narrator of Heart of Darkness feels like, you know, they were wandering on prehistoric Earth when they were in Africa. So they are literally, you know, spatializing, you know, time, that you move from one continent to another, you have moved in time, right? So literary fiction and pulp fiction and this genre, you know, big genre cultural system, the mass cultural system, you know, so this phenomenon that you find in early work, now what is happening now with futurisms is that this phenomenon is very much back. Futurisms are rejecting, often enough, rejecting the genre labels of science fiction. They are not interested really in the questions of, you know, what constitutes science, in the sense that they're not interested in a very, you know, monolithic understanding of science. Science is a much more open kind of idea. For instance, in indigenous futurisms, right, there is a whole discussion around, you know, indigenous knowledges or traditional knowledges, right, which are also extremely futuristic at the same time. Right. So the notion of, you know, ITech, you know, indigenous technology or indigenous sciences, these are challenging this very narrowish definition of science, you know, from a very, you know, Western epistemic kind of perspective. Now, the effect of that on genre is that when you are looking at a work of indigenous futurism, the work of indigenous futurism or Afrofuturism, you don't need to understand them as science fiction. They are not making the claim that they are science fiction even. They're Afrofuturism or they're indigenous futurism, right? So they're challenging that genre. They're challenging the closure of or the silo kind of thinking around, oh, there is something called science fiction, or there is something called fantasy, or there is something called horror, and so on. They all come together. And I think a very good example of this would be the work of Stephen Graham Jones, for instance, you know, where you have indigenous futurism and horror coming together very, very clearly. So I think the 1930s, the radium age model, and why what makes these works so interesting is that they also reflect what is going on now. So to me, that was one of the most exciting things about going back to these narratives and translating them.
Yeah, no, absolutely. That sounds incredibly exciting. Thank you for sharing that with us. Staying in that kind of time of all the things that were going on, what was the reception of these stories like when they were first published?
So the reception of these stories, it is a bit hard to track the reception of early science fiction, except, I mean, the title story, Inhumans, you know, Amanushik Manush, is widely known and read. Hemant Rai has never been out of print in Bengal. He is extremely popular and remains popular. So Amanushik Manush is well known, you know, as are Hemant Rai's other narratives. Hemant Rai wrote in a variety of genres. He also wrote a lot of, you know, adventure fiction and detective fiction. So he is very well known. And Mongol Puran, the last story, you know, that has also, you know, that is also comparatively better known than some of the others. Jogananda Rai's Shukra Bhraman, or Travels to Venus, is kind of interesting because there is a lot of misconception about this particular story. Until recently, we didn't even know when exactly this work was published. So, you know, so one had to go back to the archives. One had to go back to, you know, to the magazines to look at where was this work first published, right? So a lot of the publication records get lost when things are published in magazines and so on. And their reception becomes hard to track. Shukra Bhraman, Travels to Venus by Jogananda Rai, it was published in an anthology later. That is why it survived, the story survived. But, you know, where it was published and so on, that was archival work. Same with, you know, The Inhumans. The story has never been out of print. The book has never been out of print, you know. But when was it first published, right? And it's very, very difficult to track it. Now, I had to go back and I had to look at, the annual publication records of new works coming out in Bangla and track them to find this particular narrative. Like, oh, there it is, Amanushik Manush, right? So it was published in 1935, yay, all right? So the interesting thing is when I did my PhD, I didn't have an exact date for Amanushik Manush, because back then, you know, the sources, you know, I only had a later source for this book, which kept saying that it was published in 1930s, right? But nobody could say when exactly was it published, who was the publisher. So I couldn't do that during my PhD. So I'm really lucky that I was able to do that for this this book. So yeah.
Yeah, amazing to finally find it after all of that. You talked earlier about some really interesting similarities, I suppose we can see, or links between the sort of mix of genres and how there weren't these sort of separate boundaries in the 1930s, and that we're seeing a lot of that as well now that it's come back. Are there any other links you think are interesting to discuss between the writing, between kind of the challenges people were talking about, the tropes in the world in which these pieces were written and today?
I think the main, so to me, why I love these works and why I continue to work on these issues are that resonance. The fact that these works continue to hold a lot of value. Now, as I said, Hemen Rai has never gone out of print. Why? What makes these stories, like Hemen Rai is writing, you know, back in the 1920s, 30s, 40s, you know, why are these works still read? Why do they remain as wildly popular as they were back in the day? You know, very recently, you know, Kalpo Bisho, this very, you know, this excellent group from, you know, from Kolkata, they have been digitizing a lot of colonial Bangla science fiction. They have been publishing new editions and so on. So they published two new editions of a two-volume compilation of Hemen Rai's science fiction stories. So, you know, and also a critical volume, you know, by Pradosh Bhattacharya on Hemen Rai. Now, what makes this work still so popular? Why are people still interested in this, right? So for me, this was kind of a key thing, right? That, you know, to investigate, you know, why is this work still popular? Right? So when we think of that question, you know, works remain popular because they tell us something about the here and now, right? Otherwise, they would be forgotten. They would be lost in the mists of time, right? So there has to be something to them. There has to be something culturally, stylistically, you know, maybe in terms of, like, purely in terms of language, you know, what makes a timeless work, right? What makes this work read, you know, almost 100 years after it was originally published? So I think what makes these works really, really special, both to me and to the Bengali reader, is the kind of narrative that Hemen Rai is, you know, in Humans, the kind of narrative that he's building about Bengal and the Bengali cultural context. Now, if one looks at some of the you know, the opening lines that I have translated, you know, in this, you know, some of the opening lines, that, you know, Bengalis have a lot of cultural anxiety about being, you know, being lazy people, right? They're often seen as lazy, quite simply because, you know, they don't want to travel much. They're very happy and they're very comfortable in their own kind of life, but they don't want to travel, right? So there is a, you know, so Hemen Rai is poking fun, of course, at the kind of, you know, cultural mindset that one often finds in Bengal, which is very, you know, very, very closed in, right? And this is interesting that Hemen Rai is writing this in 1935. You know, this is right after, you know, nearly, you know, more, not nearly, but more than a century of British colonialism at that point of time in Bengal, right? And Bengal had a lot of cultural contact with the outside world, right? So the fact that, you know, Hemen Rai takes that, and by the 1930s, you know, he feels that somehow Bengalis are very happy with their, you know, books and their learning and so on and so forth, but they're very reluctant to have an adventure. They're very reluctant to go out. They're very reluctant to explore and to understand the rest of the world. So they're not adventurous people. I think this kind of gentle critique that, you know, Hemen Rai has throughout the book about Bengalis, about their self-perception, also about the way they describe themselves, you know, like when we look at Bangla Kalpavigyan overall and also later works, one constantly finds this form of, you know, self-critique. You know, and I think this self-critique is so important because Bengal was a colony, right? They had to also, you know, Bengalis also had to mentally deal with the fact that this was a colonized space. They were colonized. Why did that happen? You know, is it because Bengalis were not brave enough or, you know, are not interested in fighting? Maybe they were just plain lazy, right? So this kind of, you know, gently poking fun at the Bengali context and its laziness and its lethargy, its refusal in a way to engage with the world in the form of adventure rather than in the form of books. I think these kinds of things continue to be a cultural, you know, trait in Bengalis, as in we still talk about these things that, you know, Bengalis love their books. You know, they love their books, they love their food, they are very happy people. They, you know, and happiness means that they're not particularly interested in adventures, outside. So the form of adventure that they find is in the form of science fiction, right? Or reading. So the cultural critique that you find, I think, makes this work really, really relevant. And I think the cultural critique is something that you find in all four works. So to me, you know, the form of the adventure narrative is definitely one thing that keeps these works popular to this day. There's also what one might call the sense of wonder about science fiction, which keeps these works popular to this day. But there's also very much this kind of, you know, self-reflexive critique about Bengalis, about Bengali culture, which also keeps these works really popular. Because we Bengalis also love to poke fun at ourselves. We don't want to take ourselves too seriously. So I think the humor, all of these things really, really help.
Yeah, I can see how that would be incredibly relevant still today. So thank you for taking us through that. This book is obviously something you've worked a lot on, but it's part of a wider collection and context of things you've been doing sort of in this vein. What are you working on now or next? Is it still around these sorts of works, or are you off to something different?
We are doing a lot of work in CoFutures, the project that I mentioned I lead at the University of Oslo. So in CoFutures, what we have been doing is we are looking at global futurisms, contemporary global futurisms, last 20 years pretty much. And we have, traveled to many countries. We have a bunch of people working on different parts of the world and different regions in their PhD and postdoc projects and so on. We have gathered a lot of data from the different places. We have spoken to a lot of people, a lot of science fiction writers and so on. I think what we are doing now is to somehow bring, or we are trying to at least bring all of these together in one space. So we have recently released, so I co-edited with colleagues, Grace Dillon, Isaiah Levin III, and Taryn J. Taylor. So we edited the Routledge Handbook of Co-Futurisms. Taryn and I, we edit a series with Routledge, Studies in Global Genre Fiction, which again looks at both the historical and contemporary dimensions. So we are doing a lot of academic work around futurisms, around science fiction, and so on. So what I'm doing now, we are actually in the process of producing more documentary films. So I mentioned the first documentary film on Bangla science fiction. You can check it out at kalpavigyan.com. It's free to watch online with multiple language subtitles. But we are also working on more documentaries. We are working on a large kind of like media library and, training courses and stuff like that. So there's a lot of different things that is coming out of our work with CoFutures. My own translation work, I think, there's another volume of translations that has come out with Siegel, University of Chicago Press. It's the Epic of Domrudhar, which is based on Domrucharit, which is another set of stories from colonial Bengal. Also kind of this kind of a weird genre mix of stories. So I think my work on translations is more or less completed, or at least it is more or less completed for now. I might go back to it, but most of the work that I do now is contemporary science fiction, is contemporary futurisms, looking at contemporary Indian science fiction, for instance, and Latin American science fiction and Chinese science fiction. Mm-hmm. So we have a lot of fiction anthologies as well coming out. Mm-hmm. So cofutures.org is kind of the website, and we put everything, we dump everything there, whatever we do. So that's where all the information is.
Brilliant. Well, I'm sure people will want to go check that out. And of course, they can read the book we've been discussing, titled The Inhumans and Other Stories, published by MIT Press as part of the Radium Age series. Bodhisattva, thank you so much for being with us on the podcast.
A pleasure. Thank you so much for this.